Neil Nunes.
Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro, is being held at a detention center in New York after being captured by U.S. forces yesterday during a raid in Caracas. He's expected to face drugs and terrorism charges. President Trump says the United States will run Venezuela until what he calls a safe transition of power can be ensured. The vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, has been declared interim leader. A resident in Caracas who asked not to be named on air has told the BBC that while no one wanted this kind of transition, something needed to happen.
What I really want for the foreigners is to understand that this is not about the oil for us. This is about the freedom of Venezuela. It's been 16 years under this regimen. And what simply we want is just to people live without fear and to be able to imagine a better future for ourselves.
Sir Keir Starmer says the government will discuss the situation in Venezuela with Washington in the coming days. The prime minister has backed a transition of power, but the Liberal Democrats, Greens and the SNP are urging him to condemn Mr. Trump's action. The prime minister has said it's in our national interest to bring the UK and EU closer together. Speaking on the Sunday with Laura Koonsberg programme, Sir Keir said Britain should consider where its rules and regulations could be aligned with the EU's single market, adding that the existing deal already makes it easier for businesses to trade. Police in Switzerland have identified a further 16 victims of a bar fire that killed 40 people in the ski resort of Crans-Montana. Nine of those identified were under the age of 18. The group includes Italian, Romanian, Turkish and French nationals. In total, 24 people have now been identified. Flights to and from Greece have been suspended following a technical failure at the country's air traffic control. Radio communications have been affected across Greek airspace. The weather, cold and bright for many, with scattered snow showers in northern Scotland and northern Ireland and a few in West Wales and the southwest of England. BBC News and weather at 12:02. Now, it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
The best-selling writer Alison Weir knows precisely what sparked her interest in history. At the age of 14, she read what she calls a really trashy novel about Catherine of Aragon, and a lifelong passion began. Well, since then, she's written some 38 books, selling more than 3 million copies around the world. Her non-fiction titles include biographies of Eleanor of Aquitaine, Isabella of France, Mary Queen of Scots, and Elizabeth of York. She's also written many historical novels, including a book about each of Henry VIII's six wives. In her most recent novel, The Cardinal, she focuses on the rise and fall of Thomas Wolsey, who enjoyed a prominent and powerful role in the court of Henry VIII. I must ask you, Alison, whether you had as much trouble choosing your list as Henry had choosing his wives.
No, I didn't, because one of my great passions is music, and I've been spending a lot of time curating my playlist.
So you didn't agonise in choosing Bach, Beethoven, Ravel, Purcell. But I'm glad to say we're going to begin with something from the Tudor period.
Yes, and this is the Pavane La Bataille, and it appears in a collection called The Dancery, compiled by a music publisher, Tilman Suzzato, in 1551. He may well have composed it, we don't know. But it's performed by the Early Music Consort of London, conducted by the late, great David Munro, who sadly committed suicide in 1976, but was the first to start to realise early music and take it seriously as an art form.
Thank you. La Bataille by Suzzato, performed by the Early Music Consort of London, directed by David Munro. Does that conjure up for you what attracted you to the period so much?
It does. It conjures up the magnificence of the Renaissance courts. I remember giving my first ever event in the Great Hall at Hampton Court Palace, and I played this before the presentation. And to hear it played in that wonderful soaring space with that amazing hammer beam roof in Henry VIII's palace was quite an experience.
Do you have a favourite Tudor, Alison?
It's probably Elizabeth I, because I have great admiration for her. But I'd say I'm probably more fascinated by her mother, Anne Boleyn, because there are still unanswered questions about her life. What was she really like? And in some ways, she's unknowable, so she endlessly fascinates, and there is a lot of debate about her.
Well, we have one or two unknowables about your early life, so fill us in a little bit.
Right. Well, I was brought up in Westminster, actually, in St Thomas's Mansions, just over the river from Big Ben, and was brought up with a family that loved music. We had gramophone, and it had 78s and a box of needles. And you could only play, use one needle for three records and 78 records. And my poor grandmother, we used to pester her. And I can remember dancing along to Liszt's Hungarian Rhapsody No. 5 as a child, or Perry Como, Mandolins in the Moonlight. And I went to the City of London School, later trained as a teacher. Much later, I ran my own school for children with special needs, because my son had special needs. And then I joined the civil service soon after I married. My husband and I had a very happy marriage for 52 years, so sadly he died 2 years ago.
In contrast to your parents, who split up when you were 11, didn't they?
Yes, they did, very messily too. My father didn't make life very easy, let's say that, and I stopped seeing him when I was 18. So that rather overshadowed my teens, although I do remember the 60s as being a very happy time to be a youngster. It was a great time, a burgeoning music, art, fashion. It was great.
I think this piece is very much a reminder for you of your mum.
It is, and that's why I've chosen it. My mother died in 2020, 3 days before my son, so 1 week into lockdown, so it was a very difficult time. But my mother, I was very close to my mother because, there was just her and I when I was growing up as my teens, and I remained close to her. And she was always a fund of wonderful stories about the war. She had a great war. She had 100 servicemen's names and addresses in a little book. Brilliant war. I say she really raised the morale of the British Army. But she did. And she had lots of stories to tell. And I used to take her down to where they used to live in Orr above Hastings, from where she watched the Battle of Britain as it took place from the Downs. I used to take her down for holidays. And when she died, we inherited her house and we bought a place down there. So we have a little place down there. And I'm always thinking about it. We drive round and her memories of the war. And so I had to choose the Dam Busters March by Eric Coates.
It's a very good tune.
It is. And it takes me back to my childhood because it was always being played on the radio. how proud my mother would have been to hear that dedicated to her.
The Dam Busters March, written by Eric Coates, in the recording by Elga House and the Philip Jones Brass Ensemble. In fact, that's a brilliant arrangement of an orchestral score.
It is, and actually I was quite surprised to find that it was played by the Philip Jones Brass Ensemble, because they started off playing early music.
Exactly.
And that's how I got into them. But I also found that I had an LP, God, that does date me, doesn't it? Of sort of British patriotic music from the mid-20th century, like coronation marches and things like that, and that was on it.
Your mum sounds like quite a character.
Oh, she was. She tap danced her way through life. She was wonderful. A very strong character, wonderful sense of humour, and very kind, and very loving. I was very blessed to have my mother.
What did she make of your success?
Oh, she was terribly, terribly proud. But I mean, she was the one who walked me into that library when I was 14 and said, get a book, because I graduated from books to pop magazines and things. And she said, get a book. So I walked around very bored in this adult library and found this lurid jacket. And I devoured this book in 2 days, and this passion was born overnight.
It was about Henry and Catherine of Aragon.
Yeah, and Anne Boleyn. It was this love triangle. And the City of London School had a very good history library, so I went dashing off to find out if this was really the truth. I have to say that the book was, well, we're talking about 1965, slightly naughty for that time. I'd never read anything with sex in it. And I thought, God, did they really go on like that in those days? Well, yes, they did. And she was over the moon. She really was very, very proud. She did everything she could. There wasn't a lot of money, but I still have the set of postcards she bought me at Hampton Court of Henry VIII's wives. She was very supportive.
How important was history to you at school then?
Not very important before then. I have to say, I think it was deadly the way it was taught. And we did do the Tudors. I don't remember it, but I have the exercise book to prove it.
You began writing, but by 15, you'd already got a few works under your belt, hadn't you?
I had. I wrote this 3-volume history of the English monarchy, and I wrote a biography of Anne Boleyn, and I did Royal Family Trees on rolls of wallpaper, and started this book that was a dictionary of British royal biography that later became my first book, Britain's Royal Families, not in dictionary form, but in chronological form. I did a lot of drawing because I studied art. I wrote a lot of poetry. I wrote plays and even wrote novels. I wouldn't want you to read them now. Well, you can have a laugh reading a couple of extracts on my website.
You also sang in the school choir.
I did, yes, but not for very long.
But nevertheless, I think it does.
I loved it. We sang part of Messiah and a bit of Bach and that. It was beautiful. But I resented having to stay behind after school. I liked my freedom.
Were there favourite bits which have led to your next choice?
Yes, because I fell in love with Messiah at a young age, between 11 and 12. I have since nurtured a love for Baroque music and Handel in particular, and Purcell. And the piece from Handel's Messiah I've chosen is For Unto Us a Child is Born. And I can't hear the bit at the end with that wonderful drum roll without tearing up, actually, because it brings me back to a time, and I don't want to sound as if I'm saying something that's not quite right here, but when my son was born, it just had such resonance. And I remember hearing it and standing in church with him in my arms when he was a tiny baby. But it is the most wonderful piece of music. Handel's work is sublime. And I think when he wrote it and he says something like, I did see the great God before me as I wrote it. I remember dragging my husband to see Messiah at the Albert Hall. And he says, can we leave in the interval? He wasn't into that kind of music at all. He loved more modern classical music. And everybody stands up in emulation of George II for the Hallelujah chorus. He said, what are we doing?
It's a lovely bit to sing this. I don't know if you actually sang this.
I did, yes. We used to sing because a lot of it's in 5 parts, and that's what I did learn in the choir at school.
You see, that's a fascinating thing, I think, about education, is that the opportunity to do things like that stay with you for life.
Yes, and if you've ever been to a sung Messiah, that's absolutely wonderful. Just to be able to take a part and sing it, it's amazing.
It seems odd to put For Unto Us a Child Is Born into the same bracket as the Dambusters March, but they both get the home fires burning.
They do, absolutely. And I love this particular version of For Unto Us a Child Is Born by Sir Malcolm Sargent of the Huddersfield Choral Society and the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic, because it's recorded in 1958, and that's pretty good stereo sound for that era. And I think it's got the resonance.
Alison Weir, as you said, you trained to be a history teacher, but you didn't actually become one. What put you off in the end?
Modern teaching methods, the international teaching alphabet. We're talking about the early 1970s at that time. Mm. I'd been to a girls' private school, learned in a very formal situation with rows of desks. The schools I was teaching in, primary schools, children were just running around choosing their own seats around tables, and in some schools choosing their own break times. And I just couldn't cope.
So what did you do at the civil service?
I was worked for what was the Department of Health and Social Security, and I rose through the ranks and went into management in the civil service. I ended up as a staff training officer and a local insurance officer, adjudicating on cases where benefit had been disallowed and the claimant had appealed. And I used to have to represent the department at tribunals and things like that.
You're clearly someone who admirably follows through, does what she wants to do.
It wasn't, I wanted to do history. History was a hobby for all this time. I didn't actually get into print till I was 38. And since then, since I have got into print, I've written up a lot of that work that I did in earlier years.
Yeah. You weren't put off by the fact that these books weren't initially published?
No, I just loved doing it. I mean, it was a dream to have a book published. And when it actually happened, you could have knocked me down with a feather. I'd submitted things over the years, not many, because I got very demoralised when the rejections came back. One said, my first version of my book on the Six Wives of Henry VIII was 1,024 pages, not double-spaced. And it came back with a snide comment, there is a world paper shortage.
Well, it's good that you can laugh about that.
Well,
now,
I can now, yes.
Given the success you've had.
Yes, absolutely.
The first published book was called Britain's Royal Families.
Yes.
That came out in 89, I think.
Yes, it did.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, this is the project I've worked on for 22 years, since my mid-teens. And it was a dictionary of, you know, an alphabetical order of every member of the British royal family going back to the year 802, with the Kingdom of Wessex, King Egbert, right up to the present monarchy. And I kept revising it over the years, re-researching it. And it was my bank of information as a base for projects I wanted to work on. And it occurred to me at some point that other people might find it helpful. And so I pulled it around into chronological order, monarch by monarch, and all their families, all their illegitimate children and their wives and connections, with linking chapters. And I submitted it to an agent who'd been interested in my work before, but the project I'd sent wasn't very strong. This is 1981. I mentioned doing a book about the future Princess Diana. Oh, no, nothing on her will sell.
Well, yes. That book, Britain's Royal Families, contains some quite scandalous secrets. The claim that George III secretly married
Hannah Lightfoot, yes.
A Quaker. Yeah.
I don't think it's true, but, you know, who knows?
But you couldn't bear to leave it out.
Oh, I had to put it in. One has to put the possibility in. There are question marks by quite a few of the illegitimate children. I mean, Henry I had 22 illegitimate children, at least.
And, of course, the point about the Hannah Lightfoot story was that, if true, it would mean his subsequent marriage to Queen Charlotte was bigamous, wouldn't it?
And every monarch since would not have a right to the throne.
I wonder if they're fans of your writing.
Yes, they've been very nice to me.
Your next piece pertains to your husband, Rankin. Yes. Tell me how you met.
We met at a Battle of Britain weekend dance at Kensington Town Hall. And I was 20 and my mother said, come on, come ballroom dancing with me. She was on her own and she'd not had any male interest in her life for years. She thought it wasn't right when I was growing up. It was a different era. So she said, come dancing with me. I said, I'm not going to be seen dead ballroom dancing, you know, at that age. And she persuaded me and she said, it'll be a good evening. And it was. It was a great evening. The band were fantastic. They put on some pop records in the middle. There was a buffet with drinks and it was all very social. And I noticed him sitting there and he was looking in our direction. He was actually looking at my mother, who was wearing a black velvet mini dress and had shoulder length hair. It looked very nice, very young looking. And then someone moved away and he told me he saw me. And then the next thing I knew, there was a pair of feet standing in front of me and he asked me to dance. And he kept asking me to dance. And then he asked me to go out with him. It was a very conventional courtship. We got engaged after 4 months. We both knew that that was what we wanted. Married after 14 months and had 2 children just over 10 years later.
Is it the romance of that story that actually informed your next piece?
It's the dating that informed this. I lived above Euston Fire Station. My mother and I lived in a flat above Euston Fire Station at Euston Square. And the day I met Rankin, he was transferred to a branch of Wallace Heaton, the photography shop in Euston Station, the newly opened Euston Station at that time. So he was working over the road from me. And I used to go over on a Saturday lunchtime and sit with him in the basement. And he had this tape recorder. It was like a spaceman's helmet. We're talking 1971, too. And you could slot in a cassette. It was bright yellow. And he had this cassette of the Romeo and Juliet overture. And we both fell in love with it. And, of course, I'd just seen the film The Music Lovers, Ken Russell's film, which I actually watched recently. It's an incredible film. The music is wonderful, played by André Previn and the London Symphony Orchestra for the film. And the version in the film is absolutely incredible. And so it always evokes that very happy time. I mean, it was just perfect looking
at it. Music does that, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah. It evokes a time and a place, and in this case, a person.
Thank you.
Well, I think, Alison Weir, that your relationship with Rankin was less traumatic than that between Romeo and Juliet.
It was. Yes, it was. I was quite stable and very happy.
You had two children together.
We did, yes. John was born in 82 and Kate in 84.
And he was dyspraxic, wasn't he?
Yes, which he was.
He had problems with movement coordination.
It's coordination, basically. They used to call it clumsy child syndrome. They don't use that term now for very good reasons. And it's very difficult to diagnose. It certainly was in the late 80s, early 90s. All his developmental checks were fine, but I knew there was something wrong. And I was initially written off as a neurotic mother, but I kept persisting. And they finally found out when he was six, a doctor, a school doctor, diagnosed dyspraxia.
You found it so difficult to place him in a school that being you, Alison, you took on the job yourself.
I did. Well, if I say we tried, I think it was 16 primary schools and 22 secondaries, and we could not place him. And we were told, I mean, schools were not allowed to refuse a child who had special needs. But what you were told was, don't send your son here. It won't be good for him. And they get round it that way. And what's the point of sending a child into a school like that? And you go to school, I'm talking about the 90s now. You go in and you see, they put the A stream on show on the parents' evening, and your son doesn't go into the A stream. And in nearly every school, he was bullied very badly. In the end, I thought, this is enough. So I educated my children at home.
And you taught, I think, about 17 children over 3
years.
Went
through my hands, yes, came in. Mostly children who couldn't cope in mainstream school or were between schools, waiting a place in the school they wanted. And it was company for John. School is half social.
You managed to find a school for John for his GCEs.
We did. He went to Sunnydown Boys School at Caterham, and that was the most wonderful special school for boys with specific learning difficulties but normal intelligence. And he had a fantastic headmaster. I was very, very impressed with the school. And he got 6 GCSEs, which for him was a great achievement.
Very sadly, he passed away in 2020 at the age of only 37.
Yeah,
I mean, that must have been so hard to cope, especially having got him over these mountains.
It was dreadful. Well, he'd finally got a job. It's not an easy thing for someone with John's kind of special needs to get a job, but he got a job supporting severely disabled students at Orchard Hill College. And he was very much valued there. And he was so thrilled with his job, but he had lots of bouts of ill health because he was very overweight. He was 6'9" and very overweight. And because of the dyspraxia, his impulsive eater, he couldn't control it. And in the end, though, he died of pneumonia. And 3 days after my mother had died, she was 92 and it was expected. But John, it was taken into hospital that day with what I'd thought earlier in the week was a cold. And I'd said, you can't go to hospital with a cold, John, because he'd go to hospital at the drop of a hat. And we thought he was getting better. He sounded so much more himself. They let me in. They put him in a COVID ward. I went in with the PPE on to see him. They let me in because they thought he was dying. Next day, he sounded so much better. And then they rang us the next morning. He'd gone. So it was a terrible, terrible thing to have to deal with.
This was a ghastly period for you because in 2023, Rankin died.
Yes, I know. Terrible. I know. October 23, yes. So it was a very difficult time. But for John, it was doubly difficult because John and my mother died a week into the first lockdown. And when we had the funeral, we had to wait a few weeks. There were a lot of people dying, as you can well remember. It was a joint funeral. And only 5 people were there, including the priest. And some good friends came. My cousin came. And it was horrendous. We couldn't go back to the house. There was nothing to take it off. You know, the misery of it off. You have a wake normally when someone dies. But no, we didn't have that.
It's slightly bland sometimes to say that music helps you through this period, but maybe there were pieces that...
Maybe it was very hard to listen to any music at all after that for a while.
What have you chosen?
John loved Doctor Who. He was passionate about Doctor Who. He had a full-size Dalek. He had loads of memorabilia. I think he had every Doctor Who series that ever came out on video or DVD. And so I have chosen the wonderful Song of Freedom from Series 4 of Doctor Who. And I think that's the series with David Tennant. He happened to be my favourite Doctor Who. And John loved him too. But I think John loved them all. And John played me this music and he said, listen to this, Mum. So after he died, I heard it a few times, obviously. And we couldn't have a celebration for him because the second lockdown happened. So the celebration was delayed, the celebration of his life was delayed until October 21. And everybody came. We took over a restaurant. It was a wonderful evening. We had some films of him. We had some music he liked. But we had this and played it at the end. And when we played it, everyone stood up.
Well, Song of Freedom was written by Murray Gold, and it's sung in Latin, and the translation is, with silence we shout, as long as we are among humans, let us be humane.
And that was John. He had great humanity, a lot of emotional intelligence for all his special needs. And he made a difference to the lives of some of those severely disabled students and also to our lives. He brought us a lot of love. Because when he died, I did think, you're only 37. You know, have you lived in vain? And I thought, no, nobody lives in vain if they can make a difference to someone else's life.
It's obviously overwhelming for you.
It is, yes. Well, I do play it quite a lot. I still have all the soundtrack from that celebration and I play it in the car and I'm singing along at the top of my voice to it, which I'm, mercifully I haven't done today.
Song of Freedom by Murray Gold, written for Series 4 of Doctor Who. Alison Weir, you've often taken as your subject royal women. Are you very fascinated by them?
I am. I started off, I was very interested. I think it was this interest in queens and princesses when I was a little girl from fairy stories. But when I got into my teens, I started to be interested in the lives of real queens and real princesses and was quite amazed to find out that there wasn't so much known about them or published about them. And in the 1960s, I mean, some of the women about whom I've since written biographies were literally relegated to footnotes. And I wanted to retrieve women's histories. That doesn't mean to say that women played as important a part as men generally in history or in Western history, but to say that their lives are interesting anyway. Mm. And that's what I wanted to do.
One of the figures you've written about is Eleanor of Aquitaine,
yes.
One of the most eligible women in Europe.
Yeah.
What drew you to her and her period?
There was a lot of good material about her, and it turned out to be my best-selling book to date. But I loved the subject. Eleanor of Aquitaine had an incredible personality, and that comes across. And I was very pleased when my publishers allowed me to use as the subtitle as Eleanor of Aquitaine by the wrath of God, Queen of England, and that comes from one of her letters to the Pope.
She didn't have much luck in love, Eleanor.
No, she didn't. I mean, she married Louis VII of France and complained that she'd married a monk, not a king, because he should probably have been a monk. And they had two daughters and she divorced him. And she'd already slept with her future husband, the future Henry II of England, after she probably had an affair with his father. So she had a bit of a girl.
The marriage was annulled, but she'd even been on a crusade with him, hadn't she?
She went on a crusade with Louis, yes, and the Pope, she approached the Pope for wanted a divorce, and the Pope said, started to do his bit of marriage counselling. He had a room prepared with a bed, a beautiful bed, and told them to make good use of it. another daughter was born, but no, Eleanor wanted her freedom.
But she was known for political acumen, wasn't she?
Yes, she was, but only in later life, when at the age of 65, I mean, she supported her sons in a rebellion against Henry II because he wouldn't give them any autonomy in the lands they had. And he imprisoned her for the last 16 years of his reign. And when he died and her favourite son, Richard the Lionheart, became king, she emerged from prison. Her jailers let her out. I mean, you know, they were frightened to keep her in there, knowing the king's love for his mother. And she virtually ruled England for the first 5 years of Richard's reign when he was away on crusade and in captivity. And she showed remarkable statecraft and humanity. On that, her towering reputation rests.
It is extraordinary, reading your books, how life in those days was so much up and down. Change of fortunes.
The wheel of fortune is a common motif in medieval art. And her life is very much that.
Piece by Gounod next.
Yes, absolutely. Now, I came to this in a rather roundabout route, because in 1974, David Essex starred in a film called Stardust about a rock star. And at the end, they do this TV special. He appears in it and he sings a song called Dea Sancta, glorifying women. And it's basically the same tune as the St. Cecilia Mass by Gounod. And I think this is the most wonderful, stirring piece of music. And it's far more sublime than the David Essex version.
Part 5 of the St. Cecilia Mass by Charles Gounod, The Sanctus, performed by the tenor Heinz Hopper, the Paris Conservatoire Orchestra, and the René Duclos Chorus, conducted by Jean-Claude Hartemann. Alison, that has some of the splendour, doesn't it, of the Bataille?
It does, doesn't it? I like splendid music. You've probably guessed that by now. I think music is spiritual therapy, and I think that I'm not talking about just the religious aspect of that piece of music. I think it lifts the soul.
One of the things I noticed reading your books is that you have an extraordinary gift for making history immediate, for making one want to turn the page.
Thank you.
I mean, sometimes people are rather derogatory about what they call popular history. Do you ever worry about them?
I know. I did to start with when I first published a book, a narrative history, The Wives of Henry VIII in 1991. There was a bit of stiffiness from academic historians. But we use the same sources. It's the way it's presented. And I don't have any problems with academic historians. I think their work is wonderful. We owe them a lot. It's just the way it's presented. And I think history is full of interesting people, good stories. And I think if it's told in that way, it can become much more accessible. It's for everyone. It's not just for academics.
Let's talk about your process. When you start a book, do you always have a fresh angle in mind that you want to pursue?
I never know where I'm going to go with a book. If it's going to be non-fiction, then I'm starting from scratch. I try to clear my head, have a blank slate, and just start to do the research in original sources and gradually build up the book from that. When it's fiction, I do all the research and I fictionalise the historical text.
Yeah.
So I know roughly where I'm going, but I'm never sure, quite sure, where the research will lead me.
How much do you rely on sources from the time?
Heavily. Very. For non-fiction, of course, you have to. You can only infer so much from the sources. But for fiction, you've got to be careful. Yes, you can indulge in flights of imagination. But I think what you write has to be credible within the context of what is known about your subject.
You've written extensively about Elizabeth of York, Henry VIII's mother. And I'm very interested into the reasons that take you to her again and again.
Because her life spans my two favourite periods in history. The Yorkist period, the late last of the Plantagenets, and then the early Tudor period. And that sort of year 1500 comes in the middle of a very interesting period in European history. But I'm also interested in her life and the fact she is the niece of Richard III. She's the sister of the princes in the Tower. She's the mother of Henry VIII. She's mother of the ill-fated Arthur, Prince of Wales. Again, the wheel of fortune went up and down for her. And she went from being a much loved princess to being bastardised and not imprisoned, but held in sanctuary because her mother feared what Richard III would do if she let her daughters out of sanctuary because the brothers had already disappeared. And then she marries Henry VII. And there's a sort of mythology about this. And he kept her very repressed. And his mother, Margaret Beaufort, was horrible to her. That's not true. This is a good marriage. It's a partnership. And she probably got on very well with the Lady Margaret, who had a sense of humour and adored her grandchildren. So I wanted to debunk some of these myths.
Did you discover anything in writing about her that led you and leads us to understand a bit more about Henry VIII's attitude to women?
Yes, I did, because she died when Henry was 11, young enough to still idealise his mother and not see her as a human being with faults. And I think that she was the benchmark against which he judged his wives, because she personified all the ideals of late medieval queenship. She was fruitful, she was charitable, she was a helpmeet to her husband, she was a gentle soul, and Catherine of Aragon conformed to all of those norms, Henry's first wife, but she didn't bear him a son. And fertility, you know, fruitfulness in a queen is crucial, because a king needs a son to succeed him, especially with a young dynasty. And then when Anne Boleyn comes along, she breaks all the mould, all the rules of late medieval queenship. She's a one-off. There's never been a queen like her since. So I think Henry, you know, judged all his wives against his mother and eventually found some of them wanting.
Ravel's Bolero now. Why are we having that, Alison Whip?
Well, I think that's the most wonderful, stunning piece of music. It's almost savage, and I absolutely adore it. I was always sad when Torvald Lundin did their wonderful skating achievement in 1984. That they chose such an anemic version of Bolero. But I was mentioning this to my cousin last week. She said it was all down to length. That was the version that actually had to work for them. The original is just too long.
You need a percussionist with a steady hand on the side drum.
You do indeed. Absolutely. It's stunning.
Bolero by Ravel, performed by the Johann Strauss Orchestra, conducted by André Rieu. Alison Weir, you wrote 10 books and then made the transition from fact to fiction, beginning with Lady Jane Grey.
That's correct, yes. I'd written some fiction in my teens and early 20s and didn't think it was good enough. Never submitted it. And I was researching my book on Eleanor of Aquitaine, actually, and I told you I had that bank of research I was using. So it wasn't an onerous project. I had some time on my hands. So I thought, I'm going to write a novel. I'm going to go back and do one of these projects for myself and just see how I get on with writing a novel. A reader had written and said, why don't you write a book on Lady Jane Grey? So I did. And I called it Light After the Darkness. And I wrote it, wait for this, with 16 narrators, past tense. And I rather liked it when I finished it. So I showed it to my agent. He said, riveting story, but it's faction. You've got to get off the fence and start being a novelist, to stop being a historian. So I put it in a drawer and forgot about it. And then a few years later, I took it out again and reworked it, first person, present tense. You can't write a history book like that. And that was the book that Hutchinson commissioned, on proviso I would do some work on it, because I did need to learn. You have to go back to square one and learn your writing craft all over again. When I'd done that, they wanted another one. So I ended up doing books side by side. So I do fiction in the mornings and non-fiction in the afternoons.
When you say it was like mastering a new craft, what exactly are the things that are different?
Well, every novel is different. But the advice I got, the most overpowering advice, was show rather than tell. You don't say Anne Boleyn was angry. You say Anne clenched her fists. She clenched her teeth. You show the reader. The reader's got to see it. It's got to be visual. And that's something, it takes a little while to learn it.
And looking at the books about the six wives of Henry VIII, which you do very much from their perspective, of course, Catherine Parr did at least survive.
Yes, she did.
Although that didn't stop her from living on the edge.
No, absolutely not. She was a closet Protestant at a time when Henry was burning Protestants for heresy. And she had a very narrow escape because a warrant was drawn up for her arrest and interrogation. And it was dropped in a palace gallery and someone brought it to her. And she screamed the place down. The king heard it. He sent his physician to her. He didn't come himself. But the physician said, go in to the king and tell him, you know, use all your wiles on him. And she did. And she said, if I had disputed with you on religion, it was only because, you know, you've been ill and I wanted to divert you with some conversation. And I always bow to your greater wisdom. And she laid it on with a trowel. And the next day, when the king and the queen were in the garden, the Lord Chancellor turned up with a bevy of guards to arrest her. The king went and had a real go at him. Beast, knave, he shouted. And the Chancellor scuttled off with his tail between his legs.
She had a passion for learning and was a writer.
She did. She published 3 books. She was the first queen to publish a book.
Purcell next, with Abdelaziz, which seems quite appropriate, actually, because it was written to accompany the play of the same name by Aphra Behn.
Yes.
One of the first women to make a living by writing in the Restoration.
Yes, absolutely. And I love this rondo. I love Purcell's music generally. I was well aware of Purcell, but then I saw this wonderful film came out a few years ago called England, My England, with Michael Ball as Purcell, Simon Callow's in it. And it's a wonderful evocation of the Restoration. And a lot of Purcell's works shown as they would have been played at court masks and performances. It's absolutely wonderful. But I remember the rondo being played as the theme music for the first Churchills. That came out in 1970, a BBC TV series. A wonderful series with a great acting cast. And I fell in love with this music then. Thank you.
The Rondo from Abdelaziz by Purcell, performed by the English Baroque soloists, conducted by John Elliot Gardner. Your latest novel, Alison Weir, which I've been reading very enjoyably, is called The Cardinal, and it's all about the life of, guess who, Thomas Wolsey. What took you to him?
I was sitting at dinner after a launch party with my agent and various authors and friends a couple of years ago, and we were discussing the novel I should write next, and was thinking about Richard III and wondering if I wanted to live for 2 years with Richard III. And Sarah Griswood, the historian author, was there, and she said, I know, she said, what about The Cardinal, a novel of power? And I thought, well, this is a challenge because I've never before written about a subject who's not royal. So I did a lot of research on him and got down to it very quickly, particularly on his private life. I was very intrigued by his private life because I knew he had a long-standing mistress and two children. And I wanted to explore what their lives were like because he had to keep them hidden away. And what I discovered was something that could possibly have been a very great tragedy in his life. We've only got fragments of information, but I've made out of them a narrative.
How did Wolsey manage to impress not only Henry VII, but also his son?
By his hard work and his energy, his ability, his wisdom. He was a great organiser. One of the first things Henry VIII did after his father died was ask Wolsey to organise the late king's funeral. But Henry VII sent Wolsey off on a mission very early on in the time of Wolsey's service, and he said he had to go and see the emperor over in Flanders. And Wolsey went there in such quick time, literally he's back late the next day, believe it or not, he manages to get great connections. And Henry VII said, I thought I told you to go to Flanders. He said, I've just got back. So that really did impress him.
He became Lord Chancellor, of course, and yes. But was known as the Alta Rex, the other king, a powerful but dangerous position to be in.
It was, yes. And he was totally loyal to Henry. I would say few kings had a more loyal and more hard-working minister. He would sit at his desk at 4 a.m. and work for 12 hours solid without stopping to eat or relieve himself. And that's, you know, a measure of the man's industry.
The nobility didn't really like
him. No, they didn't. They thought that by virtue of their birth and status, they should be the king's natural counsellors. And they resented someone from Wolsey's background, this new man.
And as we've heard again and again, the wheel of fortune turned and he was eventually cast away by Henry.
Yes, he was.
And estranged from those he loved.
Yes, he was. I relied quite heavily on George Cavendish's Life of Cardinal Wolsey. Cavendish was his gentleman usher. And what comes across there is how much Wolsey loved Henry. I think he loved him like a son, and how he missed Henry and how he was desperate for Henry to bring him back into the fold. But Anne Boleyn was working against that. He couldn't prevail against Anne Boleyn's influence.
It's a fascinating story. We could go on talking about it for hours, but we're going to make way for Sibelius.
Yes,
next.
We are.
Why this?
Because Finlandia is a tone poem. It's about political freedom. I'm rather like songs about freedom, as you've probably noticed by now.
Do you think music does conjure up for you a place or an area, or as here, the Deep North?
Absolutely, yes, it does. It conjures up the Deep North to me, definitely. I just think there's something very, very moving about it. It was considered subversive.
Thank you. Finlandia by Sibelius, performed by the Halle Orchestra, conducted by Sir John Barbirolli. Alison, you're an honorary life patron of the historic royal palaces and in the past have conducted tours. Do you have a favourite palace?
Hampton Court, it has to be. It's the most wonderful palace, but you could spend lifetime studying it and still find out new things about it.
It's amazing going to places like the kitchens, though.
I know. And if you go through all the attics and the grace and favour rooms, there's a 27-room apartment up there. After the fire of 1986, they stopped letting out these grace and favour rooms. And this lady lived there in the 1930s. And her two children were sleeping together in an attic. She had 27 rooms. But it's fascinating. You see Tudor mullion windows with 1970s wallpaper around them. It's amazing.
Well, we've come to your last piece, and I think it was used in the coronation of King Charles and Queen Camilla, so it does bring us up to date in a rather nice way.
Yes, it's Ihre Seide Gott gesungen by Bach. It comes from the Christmas Oratorio. And I was given this, it's hard to believe now, on a 7-inch single by a colleague I worked with in the 1970s, and I played it. I was just bowled me over. It's the most beautiful music, full of energy and full of joy, joie de vivre. It's a beautiful piece.
Well, I think it rather sums you up, that description.
Thank you.
Alison Weir, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The Christmas Oratorio, composed by Bach and performed by the Bavarian Radio Choir and the Academy for Early Music in Berlin, conducted by Peter Dijkstra. The final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, the historian and writer Alison Weir. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. Next week, Michael's guest will be the American singer and actress Vanessa Williams. And next on Radio 3, Sarah Moore Peach goes on a musical journey, taking in American jazz and Mendelssohn. Her final destination is Chopin's Nocturnes in Music Map.
BBC Radio 3, the home of classical music. When have you actually stuck to a New Year's resolution?
Well, I once planned to run every other day for a year, and I didn't even manage it every other month.
For 2026, make a resolution you can keep and try a new breakfast routine.
Wake up, put your kettle on, and ask your smart speaker to play Radio 3. It's that easy.
It's 1:30 on Radio 3, and time now to join Sarah Moore Peach on a nighttime journey that includes a teenage Mendelssohn's Paris and 1950s Las Vegas, en route to Chopin's Nocturnes, Opus 9.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map, the show where we journey towards a single destination point. And on our way, we meander through interconnected landscapes of music that relate to our destination. And as you can probably hear, the pieces we're mapping today locate us deep in the night. We're exploring the first three nocturnes by Frédéric Chopin, the 19th century Polish pianist and composer who lived most of his creative life in exile in Paris and died young. But while Chopin is known for his nocturnes, he didn't invent the form. That was the handiwork of the Irish composer John Field.